dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The system of neoliberal economics advocates a market-based, profit-making approach to universally necessary resources and services. This system is celebrated by its advocates as more efficient and productive than public or non-profit ownership. One might ask the question, for whom is this system efficient and productive? Telephone users have seen their phone bills go nowhere but up, and energy ratepayers in California were recently fleeced like sheep by energy companies like Enron. We in New York State face a similar threat this winter. The so-called free marketers have also set their sights on the Social Security system and have advocated turning it over to Wall Street. In the second hour of our program, Smithy returns with the Wizards of Money to explain how the Social Security system is actually funded, and how U.S. imperial priorities threaten the retirement benefits of future workers, and vice versa. Whereas government programs are not based on profit and are at least nominally operated for the benefit of society, the privatization of many of these functions creates an incentive for the perpetuation of social problems, since one person's problem is another person's profit. The career of Vice President Dick Cheney is an example of how the system works. In the first hour, we'll take a look at Cheney and his connection to the Halliburton Corporation.
I don't know, good horse, as we trot in this dark heat, that Robin the
Dick Cheney is a real career man. At age 33, he served in the Nixon White House and, in 1974, was assistant to President Gerald Ford, later becoming Ford's chief of staff. Then, as Secretary of Defense under the first President Bush, Cheney directed both the invasion of Panama and the Gulf War on the people of Iraq. During his post from 1989 to 1993, Cheney oversaw one of the largest privatization efforts in the history of the Pentagon, steering millions of federal dollars to civilian contractors. 2.5 years after Clinton was elected, he began cashing in on the very contracts that he helped initiate. In 1995, with no experience in the oil industry, former Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney was named CEO of Halliburton Oil Services. It appears from recent reports that Cheney's 5 years with the company were some of its most profitable. After being tapped by GW for the number two job, Cheney divested all holdings from Halliburton in August 2000, cashing in some $36 million worth of stock options on the way out. 2 months later, the company took a dive on Wall Street. In May of this year, the Securities and Exchange Commission began to examine the company's accounting practices during Cheney's tenure as CEO. To understand more about these dealings, we turn now to investigative reporter Protop Chatterjee. Protop first looked into Halliburton as research coordinator for Project Underground, the Berkeley-based environmental watchdog group. He has written extensively about corporate wrongdoing, with more than 1,000 articles printed in journals like Multinational Monitor, The Progressive, The Guardian, and the Financial Times of London, just to name a few. He currently writes for CorpWatch.org and is the co-host of Terra Verde, heard each Friday afternoon on KPFA in Berkeley, California. Earlier this year, Protop Chatterjee was on assignment in Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. I spoke with him by telephone from his home in Berkeley, California, prior to the program.
Halliburton is a Dallas-based oil company, and on their website, one can read that they were founded in 1919 and that they're one of the world's largest providers of products and services to the petroleum and energy industries. Now, I think a lot of people are kind of unfamiliar with exactly what Halliburton does. Can you
They're not an oil company in the sense that they don't drill for oil, but they're really more of a construction company. Mm-hmm. And a service provider to the oil industry, among other industries. So what they do basically is, let's say you're Exxon and you want to build a pipeline. They might come in and help build a pipeline. Or you want a drilling rig, let's say in the Gulf of Mexico. They would construct that. In fact, a lot of their work involves drilling rigs in the North Sea, in the Gulf of Mexico, and places like that. So they provide services to those big oil companies. They are the world's largest provider of such services, and they work in, I believe, 130 countries around the world. I forget the exact number. They most certainly work in countries like Angola, in Bangladesh. They now own a subsidiary that works in Iraq. Mm-hmm. They've certainly worked in, you know, countries spanning the globe in the oil industry, but also, and especially since Dick Cheney's taking over as chief executive in the latter part of the 90s, they've been working for the U.S. military in a big way. And I want to stress that this is not the first time they worked for the U.S. military. It wasn't simply as a result of Dick Cheney's taking over the company. Halliburton owns a company called Brown & Root. And Brown & Root has for years provided services to the military. Maybe not as much as they do today, but back in the 60s, they built the U.S. bases in South Vietnam. So they were big construction contractor to the U.S. Army.
Our vice president was the former CEO of Halliburton. He took over in 1995. He was the Secretary of Defense, or Secretary of War, as some call it, under the first Bush, and he orchestrated the Gulf War. Also, during his tenure at Halliburton, the company doubled in size, and this was done through a series of mergers and contracts. Can you explain how this is accomplished?
Yeah, so Dick Cheney, who was until relatively recently a career politician, became Secretary of Defense, and Secretary of War is a good title because the Department of Defense, as it's now called, was once the Department of War. And effectively, that's what it does, is, you know, it goes to war in places, invades places. So anyway, Dick Cheney was in charge of the Gulf War, and he invaded Iraq, or led the invasion of Iraq. And at the time, listeners might recall that the U.S. government was under a lot of pressure to reduce the size of its standing army and military operations at the end of the Cold War. It's a bloated bureaucracy, very huge, in fact, probably the largest, today the largest centrally planned system in the world. In size, it was only exceeded in terms of a centrally planned bureaucracy by the Soviet Union itself. And now with the demise of the Soviet Union, the U.S. Army is now the world's largest bureaucracy. And it's incredibly bureaucratic. I spent a little time looking into the operations in Afghanistan and the various contracting that it does, Halliburton being one of the contractors. And it's really Byzantine, the size and the layers and that kind of thing. Anyway, so one of the things that Dick Cheney was in charge of in 1992 was to try and streamline that. So he approached contractors. Brown & Root was one of them, in fact. But basically, it was to look into the possibility of turning over some of these operations to civilians. Mm-hmm. So Brown & Root did a little study, sent it back to Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney looked at it, and then he said, why don't you come up with realistic plans? So paid them a little bit more money, and they came up with a realistic plan. They put it out to bid, and Brown & Root got the first contract. Since then, they've gotten several more contracts. They're now on their third contract. The first contract was signed, I think, in 92. And the second one was in 96. And they actually lost the second contract to a rival called DynCorp. Mm-hmm. However, at that point, they had already started working in Bosnia. And so when the U.S. Army, despite the fact that the contract had been won by DynCorp, decided they wanted to continue with the existing contractor for the Bosnian operations and Operation Gatekeeper, the quote-unquote peacekeeping operations in former Yugoslavia. And that actually became very lucrative and multiplied to a multi-billion dollar contract over its lifespan, in fact, continues today. So Dick Cheney at this point had become chief executive officer. After he left being Secretary of Defense, he spent a couple of years, you know, involved in various think tanks.
And he, in fact, authorized these contracts in 92 as Secretary of Defense?
Indeed, he did. Now, the name of this contract is something called LOGCAP, the Logistics Civilian Augmentation Program. And basically, it involves what sometimes, you know, one might think of as MASH duties, as in the television series MASH. It involves schlepping and setting up tents, providing food, running messes, running laundry facilities, perhaps setting up hospitals, and that kind of thing. The U.S. Army has always used civilian contractors on a small scale. In the operations in the Gulf War, under Dick Cheney, there's one in a 100 of the people involved on military bases was a civilian. By and large, the U.S. Army set up its own tents. You know, the soldiers, you know, dug their own latrines and cleaned them up. But the Army made this argument that, you know, our soldiers are valuable products of a training system. They don't need to do this kind of thing. So come Bosnia, come Operation Gatekeeper, something like 1 in 10 people on a U.S. base was a civilian. And mostly civilians in Bosnia were either employees or contractors to Brown and Root. And basically, if you were a U.S. soldier and you were flying to Bosnia, the first person that would meet you off the plane, their meet and greet, would be a Brown and Root employee with a baseball cap, probably emblazoned Brown and Root, who would give you your assigned quarters, show you where the laundry was, where your food was, and then often would help transport stuff for you and that kind of thing. This was a major contract for Brown and Root, subsidiary of Halliburton, during the course of Operation Gatekeeper. Now, remember I mentioned that DynCorp had the main contract, even though Brown and Root got the bulk of the work. This contract expired beginning of this year, and late last year, the Army awarded the third contract, and this time they took it back from DynCorp, who had, in the meantime, been involved in some rather embarrassing scandals with their employees in Bosnia, being involved in procuring women and that kind of thing for prostitution. So DynCorp lost the contract. We don't know if it was because of that. We do know that Brown and Root had, you know, won, you know, various awards for its work in the former Yugoslavia, for its work in Fort Benning, Georgia, the School of the Americas, where they did construction for the government, for the U.S. military. And so the U.S. military gave them the new contract. So as of 2002, for the next 10 years, Brown and Root can be called with 72 hours notice to go anywhere in the world and set up facilities for, you know, 20,000 troops using a kit called Force Provider or a variety of other systems. And the U.S. military is authorized to send them wherever they want for any sum of money. There is no cap on the spending. So they get a contract, and once they have that contract, they can make up to 9% in profits if they perform the job well. And they've always gotten that top dollar for their contract so far. And their latest assignment is in Uzbekistan, on the border of Afghanistan, in a place called Khanabad, from where the U.S. launched the first strikes against the Taliban government in Afghanistan. So Khanabad, which is in central Uzbekistan, it's pretty far from you know, the major population centers. It's the closest town is a town called Karshi, but it's far from Tashkent. It's where the 10th Mountain Division from, I think it's Fort Drum in New York, is based. Brown and Root is now in charge of running that base. The prefab kits, Force Provider, that kind of thing, operated as of the 10th of June, about a month or so ago, by Brown and Root. And it's a more recent contract. I was there, actually, in January, and I was still trying to find out, you know, if there are any civilian contractors. But the U.S. Army doesn't want civilians involved in direct zones of conflict right at the very beginning. But they eventually, as in the case of Bosnia, they actually get quite closely involved in supporting troops. They're not involved in any combat operations whatsoever, but they often follow the troops and set up behind them. They did that, you know, in Bosnia, and we don't know really in Uzbekistan whether they're doing that. Right now they're simply running, you know, the logistics support.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk a bit more about Brown and Root, actually, and kind of localize it for our listeners here in Santa Cruz. In February of 2002, Halliburton paid out $2 million to settle an allegation made by a former employee of Brown and Root, their subsidiary. And the employee accused the company of overbilling the government for work at the Fort Ord base near Monterey, California, that was never done. Now, of course, the big headlines are involving the Security and Exchange Commission's recent investigation into Halliburton that was launched in late May. Is this a similar type of allegation that they're looking into? I mean, what can you kind of explain the practices
of
the SEC?
It's an accounting matter. It's a question of overbilling and that kind of thing. I would say that it's similar, but on paper, I'm sure that Halliburton and the Army would argue that it is somewhat different. So let me just explain what happened
okay. In
Fort Ord, what happened and what the SEC is looking into. They're really basically different. It's patterns of abuse using different accounting systems and tender regimes and that kind of thing. But basically, I think amounts to the same thing. Basically, in Fort Ord, what happens in a lot of these domestic contracts is that a company sends in a bid, and they what they call a contractor's pricing proposal. So let's say Brown and Root says, we will help you. In fact, they said, we will help you shut down the Fort Ord base in Monterey. And the way we will do this is we will need to buy 3 trucks, 5 ladders, 17 wrenches, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very detailed proposal. Mm-hmm. And this proposal is based on an Army manual which says, thou shalt not charge more than $10 for a wrench, $100 for a ladder, mm-hmm. and $20,000 for a truck, whatever it may be. So they provide this very detailed proposal. The Army approves it, and they say, okay, we'll pay you $50 million to clean up the base. And the two sides then sit down, and they draw up what's called a statement of work. And the statement of work is very different from the contractor's pricing proposal. It simply states what Brown and Root needs to achieve. It doesn't involve the number of trucks or wrenches or ladders. It simply says this is what you have to achieve. So you're not allowed to, you can't just go and buy the most expensive trucks, you know, available and pay a premium for it. You cannot charge more than the price stipulated in the Army manual of these 10,000 different things. However, since the statement of work doesn't actually specify how you're going to do this, you could in your contractor's pricing proposal, actually inflate the number of pieces of equipment that you're about to buy, and you say, I need 5 trucks, when in reality you only need 3 trucks. And then in the statement of work it simply says, move X amounts of gravel. So you then go out and buy 3 trucks instead of 5, and you pocket the change for the extra 2 trucks because you never bought them. This is what this whistleblower, a contractor in Fort Ord, Diamond Campbell, alleged, that on 260 occasions the contractor, Brown and Root, did not do what it said it would do in the original proposal. So the Department of Justice, the Attorney General's office, sued Halliburton for this discrepancy of some $6 million. Halliburton made the argument that they were not obliged, there was no legal requirement for them to do what they said they would do in the contractor's pricing proposal, because it was simply a proposal. On the other hand, they were obliged to do what was stated in the statement of work, and they had done that. The Attorney General's office took a dim view of that, and I was talking to the man who was prosecuting them, and he said that morally they were basically ripping us off. Now, what Brown and Root possibly realized, in fact, we know they realized, was that this might have a material effect on their contract with the U.S. government. In December, recall, they had gotten a contract, unlimited 10-year contract to go work on bases overseas. This is a brand new contract, and if somebody spotted the fact that they was under investigation by, you know, and being sued by the Department of Justice, or injustice, as you may care to call it, then the contract could have been in jeopardy. in their latest annual account, they actually state, we settled for $2 million, and we believe, as a result, this will provide no conflict with our current contracts. Because the U.S. government can, well, not that it hasn't, but technically is not supposed to do business with somebody that they've sued or these kinds of matters. So they settled for $2 million, so it's less than the $6 million that was alleged. But the Army was happy to get some money back, and there the matter ended. The whistleblower got a percentage of the money, because, I mean, effectively now he can't work for anybody else. Certainly the Army and the Brown Root are not about to hire somebody who might snitch on them. Now, what the SEC is investigating is something a little different. Basically, in their accounts, they go to clients and they say to a client, we're going to charge $100 million to construct, let's say, this oil drilling rig in the Gulf of Mexico. Client says, okay, that's fine. Now, remember, in Fort Ord, they can't overbill. They get a fixed sum of money. They can under-purchase or maybe do a shoddier job or some such thing. In the case of the logistics support activity, they can charge a profit of 9%. In the case of the corporation, that the SEC investigation of their contracts with corporations, they basically state to clients they're going to cost, it's going to cost $100 million to build a rig. However, once they go and do it, they then present them with the bill and show that the number of hours they spend, the equipment they purchase, actually totaled up to $140 million. And typically, this happens, the cost overruns are very routine in a lot of contract work, and clients eventually pay it. So what Brown & Root said was they won their bids based on, low-priced contract, but then they turned around to shareholders and they said, hey, our revenue is going to be $140 million. Because they knew that this thing was going to be overbilled simply because maybe they'd already spent the money. And so they asked their shareholders, they told their shareholders that their revenue was higher than the contracts that they actually signed. Now, ultimately, that money came in, but it's not a normal way of doing business. When you report to your shareholders how much income you're expecting to get, you base it on the contracts you've actually signed as opposed to how much you're going to overbill them by. And that's what they were doing. That's what the SEC is looking into.
We're speaking with investigative reporter Protop Chatterjee, and this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and you're listening to Rockin' the Boat. My name's the V-Man, and Protop, in 1996, Dick Cheney appeared in a video that is now surfacing for the disgraced accounting firm Arthur Andersen. In this video, the vice president states,
the company obviously has a long historic relationship with Arthur Andersen. Been a very important part of the business. They've got the traditional role to fill as our auditors. They do that extraordinarily well. I've worked with them in some other settings as well, too. They also have, one of the things I like that they do for us is, in effect, I get good advice, if you will, from their people based upon how we're doing business and how we're operating, over and above just sort of the normal by-the-books auditing arrangement.
Your reaction to this statement, Protop Chatterjee?
Well, again, and maybe I'm playing a little bit of devil's advocate here, it was a promotional video. And a lot of people have pointed to it as, hinting that, they'll do more than is required, and that suggests something illegal. What he's really referring to here, Dick Cheney, is two things. One is, you and me and everybody else who goes to an accountant to pay our taxes will say, well, how can we best present our accounts to the U.S. government so we pay the least amount of taxes? And accountants the world over present creative ways, especially the wealthier you are, and the wealthy do not pay taxes because they have very creative accountants who know the law, or perhaps in some instances have helped write that law in Congress, and know how to use the law in order to, with loopholes in order to save money and pay the least amount of taxes. So that's one possible reference that he's making. But actually, I think primarily what he's referring to is something that's come under a lot of criticism, is the fact that companies like Arthur Andersen provide services other than accounting, which is consulting. And so they'll come in and they'll tell them how best to manage the business. So they will come in and say, we can tell you better than your CEO or your MBAs how to run this business in an efficient fashion. And accounting firms, until perhaps 20-plus years ago, never did this kind of thing. They simply came in, looked at your books, and then walked away. And they were supposedly independent and liable, you know, since they signed these accounts. If there was any fraud discovered, they could be investigated. Now, since for many years, shareholders and government regulators simply, look at a set of accounts, never investigate it if it's been signed by, you know, a large accounting firm. What was once known as the Big Eight, and now I think is the Big Six, or maybe it's down to the Big Four now, I can't recall. And nobody really looked into great details. Now, the accountants themselves, as we've discovered with Arthur Andersen, never paid a lot of attention. Well, one thing that listeners probably don't know is more than 15 years ago, I used to be an accountancy journalist, and I wrote for a newspaper called the Financial Times in London. My job was looking into these accounting standards, and I spent a lot of time hanging out with accountants. Like people at Arthur Andersen, I, curiously enough, used to hang out with the guy who ran Arthur Andersen's consulting practice, a guy called George Shaheen, who then went on to WebVan to work in Silicon Valley. So George Shaheen and his men basically went in and showed companies how they could do business supposedly more efficiently. And they got paid very well for this, incredibly well, thousands, tens of thousands of dollars a day. And very often, they didn't really look into anything at all. It was a very cozy relationship between one big company and the next. And apart from showing them how to diddle their accounts, they also showed them how, supposedly to save money, but also, you know, made it very lucrative for them to show them how to run a business. Now, since they were on the one hand, reporting to the government whether or not this company was doing business appropriately, on the other hand, they were also showing them how they could run the business in a way that would incur the least amount of taxes and regulation and what have you, oversight, there was a conflict of interest. And this has been a big issue in the accounting industry, and people have always said you've got to separate the two. So Arthur Andersen is actually the pioneer in many ways of this additional area of consulting, and George Shaheen created Andersen Consulting in a way that no other company had done this before. Now, all the other firms, KPMG, Pete Marwick, Arthur Young, a lot of them, Deloitte Haskins themselves, a lot of them have been renamed since I worked in this industry, so your listeners may have heard different names, but that's what they were known as 15 years ago when I wrote about these companies. They created companies that were as big as themselves, if not bigger, a little like General Motors creating, you know, a financing company, its own bank to be able to provide things on the side. They helped run companies in many ways. This, obviously, now is what's being, you know, challenged by the accounting industry, by the public, and is under so much scrutiny. And that's what Dick Cheney was referring to, was the fact that, in many ways, the management consultants would come in, have them run the company, oftentimes would place people in the company to run it. I don't know if they did that in the case of either Enron or Halliburton or what have you. Actually, I take that back. Halliburton's current chief executive used to work for a consulting company. And so this is really kind of an incestuous business in many ways.
Bringing nepotism to a new level, I see.
Yeah, and really, just to conclude that thought, Dick Cheney went from Secretary of Defense to becoming the chief executive officer of Halliburton. Now he's vice president. When he left, in order to avoid a conflict of interest, he sold all his, or an appearance of a conflict of interest, he sold all the stock options they've given him, and he pocketed $36 million or thereabouts in cash from the fact that this company was so highly valued because of the accounting tricks that it was employing. Now it's stock, you know, like a lot of other companies, more so than other companies that have suffered in the recent stock market collapse, but because of the accounting problems, you know, is way down. Had he sold his shares now, I doubt it would be worth more than a couple of $1 million. Again, these are stock options that he was given. It's not money that he earned. And he's beholden to the fact that this company, you know, earned him so much money. So he's probably still pretty helpful to them. Forget about running bases in Uzbekistan. Halliburton is in charge of rebuilding U.S. embassies around the world, protecting them against attacks, They've done that in Albania. They are currently building the prisons for the navies for Taliban prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. That's a Halliburton contract. The Defense Intelligence Agency, they won a contract about a month ago to help rebuild their headquarters. They have the contract, as I mentioned, Fort Benning, Georgia. They helped build that. They have run what's it called in Kentucky, where they stole the gold, Fort Knox. Halliburton is currently helping run that. So they have a lot of military contracts. They're currently, you know, supporting the Pentagon itself in refurbishing and building stuff in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. So they're sort of a right-hand construction logistics support arm for the military right now.
And right now we're hearing a lot of talk coming out of the White House about a possible attack on Saddam Hussein in Iraq. I'd like to talk a bit about Halliburton's connections with Saddam Hussein. Under Dick Cheney, there were two of their subsidiaries that had contracts with the Iraqi regime. Can you talk a bit about that? And we're talking about a conflict of interest. I mean, what does that say about a man who was, as Secretary of War, fought against Iraq, you know, orchestrated this war, and then becomes CEO of a company that deals directly with him three years later?
I think it's worse than you state, because as Secretary of Defense, Secretary of War, he specifically lobbied and supported an embargo of U.S. companies operating in Iraq. You know, he said that American companies had no business doing work with Saddam Hussein and people like that. Now, when he took over Halliburton was not, as far as I know, was not doing work in Iraq. However, he helped orchestrate the purchase of a company called Dresser Industries. And basically the way that happened was they were out hunting, him and the chief executive of Dresser, and they came to an agreement, you know, on one of the states in Texas to merge the two companies. Now, Dresser Industries was doing business with Iraq. And once he acquired it, I forget the exact place, but somewhere, I think in New Orleans or Louisiana, he spoke to a group of executives about the importance of, you know, working in places like Iraq, and said exactly the opposite. I mean, maybe he had a change of heart, who knows? Maybe he felt the pain and suffering of the children, the 500,000 children of Iraq that have died as a result of the embargo, who knows? He said, you know, it's important that we engage, and that he lobbied against the embargo, or at least his company did. And he was certainly backing that policy. So he went from a hawk, anti-Iraq, anti-doing business in Iraq, to somebody whose company was contracted to provide services to rebuild Iraq's oil infrastructure in Basra and places like that.
We're speaking again with Protop Chatterjee, investigative reporter. Protop, in mid-July 2002, the nonpartisan legal watchdog group Judicial Watch filed a lawsuit against Cheney and other involved directors at Halliburton. What is alleged in this shareholder lawsuit?
Judicial Watch is suing Halliburton, suing Dick Cheney, for the accounting irregularities that the SEC is looking into at Halliburton and the way it's overbilled its clients. Now, Judicial Watch is nonpartisan. I'm sure that's probably true. They're actually pretty conservative, but I don't know anything about their politics, but I do support the lawsuit because I believe they're correct in saying that Dick Cheney was chief executive of Halliburton when it made these accounting changes the SEC's investigating, showing that they were booking profits that they had not realized from their clients based on construction overruns. And so Judicial Watch is saying, you know, we as shareholders, they are representing, or maybe they themselves own a couple of shares in Halliburton, were cheated by this accounting procedure. My understanding is these are civilian contracts. They're not military contracts with oil companies, or maybe they were construction contracts, I think. May not have been for oil companies. I haven't found out yet which contracts, and I'm really curious to know which contracts they had overbilled on. But that's what Judicial Watch is looking into. And, of course, Halliburton has dismissed the lawsuit, saying, you know, this is rubbish. We stated that we were changing our accounting method. It's all there in black and white for you to see. There's nothing wrong with it. It's totally legal. But the lawsuit remains, and we'll see what happens.
Dick Cheney, historically, since taking office as vice president, has pretty much been silent on a lot of these issues. He has refused to hand over documents to the General Accounting Office, and so far has not talked about these latest foibles, for lack of a better term. Can you talk a bit about that and the likelihood of a fair, balanced investigation into these practices with Cheney not even talking?
Yeah. I don't know what kind of influence the SEC has. There was a former, I think, director or boss at the SEC who claims that his role in government will not prevent them from investigating him thoroughly in his role, if it's necessary, in the investigation of Halliburton. Dick Cheney is actually a remarkably silent man these days in all matters. He's in hiding somewhere. Who knows exactly what he's up to? Somebody sort of quipped that, you know, well, basically he's in hiding because he's doing deals with all his buddies. Now, I did talk to his office, not to him, and they swore to me that he had no role whatsoever. And I spoke also to the Mike Knoll, the man in charge of the contract for the U.S. Army for their operations overseas, and they claim that Dick Cheney had nothing to do with the contract. And to a certain extent, I believe them. I mean, there are only two or three companies that are actually capable of implementing such a large-scale project in run route, you know, by default, because of what Dick Cheney has done for them in the past, is really the only company that can do this. So that's why they got the contract. But yeah, he's been remarkably silent on many matters. We don't even know where he is half the time. So it's something that I hope will come out in the future, and hopefully people and organizations like Judicial Watch, and when I can get around to it, I would like to, you know, get Freedom of Information Act orders served on Dick Cheney to try and discover exactly what happened under his watch. The lawsuit from Judicial Watch may produce some results, although this government has certainly changed the rules of operation. They can't change the Freedom of Information Act itself, but they have certainly instructed all departments to... I've done Freedom of Information Act lawsuits against the government and won them, too. But the government can make it a very long-winded process. There's a lot of loopholes that allows them to drag it out forever. And eventually what happens is, you know, they do turn over data, but then they can black out large quantities of documents. So it remains to be seen what we'll discover. But as vice president, he's certainly using his position to stay out of the public eye and not talk about Halliburton or his role as vice president in dealing with these industries.
Given that the Central Asia and Caspian Sea regions have enormous quantities of undeveloped oil, and the fact that the United States imports more than 60% of its oil for its daily consumption, do you believe that this war on terror is just another excuse in a long line of excuses for oil exploration?
An interesting question, and certainly on the left, there's been a lot of talk of how this is really a war for oil. Personally, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so I wouldn't go so far. But what I would say is that the two do go hand in hand. There's oil in practically every country in the world, and especially in third world countries, a lot of it has not been tapped. And the oil industry has a lot of heavyweight lobbyists, who, a lot of whom are former members of the cabinet, who lobby heavily to try and get the U.S. government to get involved in these countries. So is the war in Afghanistan a war about oil? I'm not sure, but the U.S. government certainly has a strategic interest in the area. And so whether or not they send the troops there so they could clear the way to build a pipeline, I don't know. I mean, look at Somalia, for example. There's been certainly a lot of talk on the left that the war there, the U.S. involvement in the peacekeeping operations because of oil. And to date, there haven't been any pipeline operations. Of course, the situation hasn't really resolved itself much. And this is, the same thing is true in Afghanistan. There's been talk of a pipeline across Afghanistan from Dalatabad in Turkmenistan all the way down to Pakistan, to ports, you know, in the Indian Ocean to ship oil, or in this case, actually natural gas, out to ports in Europe and maybe, you know, for consumption in Pakistan or even in India. And I'm a little skeptical that this will happen in the immediate future simply because the situation is still pretty volatile. But it's definitely a question that people think about. The administration will be quite clear that they do support American companies going in and drilling for oil, that it's a strategic interest. And I've been talking a little bit to people in companies that are operating in Afghanistan, and they think it's going to take a little while. Unocal, I was talking to Unocal actually recently, and they claim they had a contract with the Taliban to build a pipeline. They've since pulled out, and Unocal assures me that they're not going to be involved in building a pipeline across Afghanistan because their plate's full. And to a certain extent, I do believe them. They have actually shut down all their operations in the region. It's not to say other companies won't be involved. My suspicion in talking to people at, you know, the Petroleum Finance Corporation, I tend to think that the reason that the U.S. is interested in pipeline options across Afghanistan is simply as a way to thwart anybody from building a pipeline across Iran. And Iran is a big enemy for them right now. It's, you know, in the axis of quote-unquote evil, as defined by George Bush. And it's not Enron, Arthur Andersen, and Halliburton. It's, you know, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. So they want to keep pipelines out of there. So they're hedging their options. They're going to support, with the help of people like the World Bank, they're going to support a pipeline through Afghanistan, even if it never gets built. And the same is true, actually, for Russia. Russia wants to make sure whatever happens, any pipeline serves their strategic interest in their former, you know, Republic of Turkmenistan. They want to make sure that nothing rocks the boat. They make the profit out of it. And so Russia would probably work with Iran if it was in their interest. But it's really sort of a great game, as people have called it, of making sure somebody has the biggest influence in the region more than anything else. There is oil there. It's going to be tapped. And they want to make sure that they have control.
That was V-Man from Free Radio Santa Cruz speaking with Protap Chatterjee.
I'm going to buy you lock, stock, and barrel. I'm going to buy you out, and there is little doubt that I'm going to make a lot of money. Then I'm going to get the hell out. Well, the first rule of the market is don't panic. And the second rule is you should panic first. Cause if everybody panics at the same time, then the whole damn stock exchange is gonna burst. This is the game of the market, where everybody's maximizing profit. Money changes hands by the dictates of demand. Oh, it's stupid, yes, but no. Well, the price of stocks is rising, it's a record. We can dance and drink martinis on the porch and pretend our profits do not come from sweatshops and that those voluntary standards are enforced. You know that people everywhere, they want our products. If they're sick and poor, we'll make them rich and well. But of course, you know, this doesn't always work out. And if those stupid schmucks rebel, we'll give them hell. This is the game of the market, where everybody's maximizing profit. Money changes hands by the dictates of demand. Well, it's stupid, yes, but nobody can stop it.
Ethan Miller with The Market Song. Though the media spotlight has been on the losses of investors, neoliberalism has created the greatest suffering among the poorest in society by dismantling the social safety net while at the same time exporting jobs to low-wage countries. In Toronto, a group called the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP, has been fighting back. They're presently in the 10th day of an occupation of an abandoned building, demanding that the city convert it into social housing. Clack Radio from Montreal spoke with Sarah Vance of OCAP on July 29th.
This is about this plot of land. This plot of land that stood empty for years. There was a corporation that owned it and evicted everyone from this place, a shitty old rooming house. and then it stayed empty for the last few years. It's no longer actually owned by that corporation that hasn't paid back taxes on it in the last 10 or so years. And so, we have, it's technically speaking, is not really owned by anybody, and now it's owned by us.
Clack Radio, produced by members of the Anti-Capitalist Convergence of Montreal. As World Youth Day descended on Toronto with the Pope's visit, Toronto Mayor Mel Aspin, quote, wished he could sweep every single homeless person under the rug. Toronto, like many other cities across Canada, is in a housing crisis. And in a province where rent control has been abolished, landlords are not being forced to make repairs, and the minimum wage has been frozen for more than 5 years. OCAP, along with other organizations and individuals, has taken action to counter this situation and has opened a squat, named for the occasion of World Youth Day, the Pope Squat. We spoke to Sarah Vance, who is with Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, about the Pope Squat.
Well, the situation in Toronto just keeps getting worse in terms of housing and poverty issues. You have a situation now where per capita, Toronto has a higher rate of homelessness than even New York City does, which is usually referred to as the homelessness capital of North America. You have a situation where 2 to 4 people are dying on the streets every week. 2,000 people in Toronto are evicted every single month, where, you know, rent control no longer exists, where people are paid $525 a month for welfare as the maximum for welfare for a single individual. But even if you rent a room in a really substandard rooming house, you're lucky to get something for $450, like very lucky, let alone trying to rent an apartment by yourself. And so, I mean, the issues are just making people's situations worse and worse and worse and more dire, and sometimes that does literally result in people's deaths and has in the past and continues to. And OCAP has lost several of its own members who've died on the streets. So using the Pope's visit here was an opportunity to highlight, I mean, politically speaking, to highlight the fact that here you have the pontiff in town. He's supposed to stand for certain moral issues. It makes it a little bit tougher for the police to come in and crack heads as they're wont to do, particularly at OCAP protests. So basically we use that to our advantage.
And what is the situation around the building? The squat was taken. People are fixing it up. How is it turning out?
Well, it's looking good. The building needs a lot of work done to it. It was extremely poorly maintained, but some basic things have happened so far that are already very positive. We've had carpenters come and repair the roof. as a starting point and have done a repair job that should last for the next 5 years and keep it from leaking. And meanwhile, on the outside, have done things like built a community garden out the front and clean out the back, and have brought an unbelievable number of couches abandoned on the street to the back of the Pope Squat, and people have been staying there for the night, and we've been showing movies and having concerts and stuff like that.
Can you speak a little bit about the support that has rallied behind this action?
Well, on all levels, the support has been awesome. We went into this with a pretty large number of endorsers and a fairly wide variety, from, like, you had your sort of alternative Catholic, Catholic worker houses, that kind of thing, endorsing it, to social justice groups, to some unions, and that kind of thing. But since it took off, there's been a huge amount of interest. So in terms of organizational support, the Canadian Auto Workers has decided to endorse the event. Buzz Hargrove is going to be speaking at the Pope Squat. He's the head of the Canadian Auto Workers Union. We've gotten a lot of support from QP. Jack Layton, who's a Toronto City Councillor, but he's also running for leadership of the NDP federally. He's been out to the building. He's working on trying to get the city on side around negotiations for keeping the building and putting money into it. So organizationally, it's great, and there's been huge numbers of people dropping by, talking about making donations, like all kinds of different initiatives that people are taking on, so that's fantastic. And then neighborhood-wise, Parkdale is just a really poor neighborhood with a lot of families who've been hit very, very hard by the kind of crisis that's going on in Toronto and more broadly across Canada. And so it's an automatic, like, it's a no-brainer for people. You bring up the issue of rent control, it only makes sense to people logically, fundamentally, that of course you support rent control. Of course you don't want to see abandoned buildings in your neighborhood. So it's been extremely good, and we're now doing stuff like, we've been going around systematically to the neighbors and talking to people and handing out leaflets, and are going to get a petition for neighborhood support started and that kind of thing. But it's been really good. I mean, to the point where the local Coffee Time is giving out OCAP newspapers at their, you know, at the, on the counter and stuff like that, and people are starting to post OCAP signs in their windows saying that, you know, that they're supportive of the action.
That's great. Why was it important for OCAP to organize this event when the Pope was in town?
Well, there's a couple of different things. I mean, you have the sort of moral weight or what have you, but you also have, like, a situation where here is the Pope coming to town, who supposedly stands for these various different moral issues, and you have, like, Ernie Eves, sitting, the Premier of Ontario, sitting down and meeting with the Pope, and Chrétien meeting with the Pope and talking about it. And then at the same time, they spent, like, millions of dollars on this event. The police have been systematically sweeping the streets of people before the event. And in fact, Mel Lastman even said, Mel Lastman, the mayor of Toronto, who doesn't really know how to keep his mouth shut, even said just before the event, when asked by a reporter, he said, yeah, I wish I could sweep all of the homeless out of Toronto. And so, and, like, that's been the sentiment around this event, is, like, clean up the city for so that the Pope doesn't have to see this kind of, like, poverty and despair and kind of things that tourists wouldn't want to see. That's what this is. It's a tourist event.
How does this action relate to the resistance that OCAP has been building over years and years and years? And OCAP is known for, you know, direct action methods. And
well, I mean, like, strategically, I think it's a development on what we've done in the past. Like, the line that we've taken is that we're not interested in merely a symbolic protest, that we want to win this building, and we want negotiations around the broader demands that have been raised as well. And so, like, that standpoint politically has developed within OCAP over the years, and June 15th, when there was the riot at Queen's Park, was the first time that it manifested itself as, like, well, we're not really interested in engaging in the kind of flag-waving anymore. We actually want to come out, and we actually want to, in the end, get something done and win something. And then building upon the development of the Ontario Common Front, we've been able to tap on like a really broad network, much, much larger than OCAP, to support the squat and to be involved in the squat and to discuss the possibility of further actions around this and look at this as much more of a campaign than just of a single incident of a, you know, one-day protest that's happened to go on a little bit longer and is just about one piece of property. Like, for us, we've put out the call to, like, give it or guard it. If they kick us off of this property, we're going to keep on coming back. And the government is going to have to make a political choice. Are they going to sink hundreds of thousands of dollars into guarding an abandoned building day and night, or are they going to sink hundreds of thousands of dollars into providing safe, affordable housing for people? And that kind of strategy of building campaigns and of coming back and of working together with allies and of following on a squat from March 22nd, but also from Quebec City squats and from the Montreal squat and from the Ottawa squat, I think is part of building broader networks, relying on one another for support and solidarity and for like learning about how to do these things and how to do them right. So we all are taking part in a broader learning curve that I think is a lot more coherent and is working a lot more successfully than it has in the recent past.
There's a lot of talk about development and, you know, finding, you know, giving social housing over, and there's talk of these things, but there's never any action, especially in the case of Montreal.
Well, I mean, I think that it's become obvious. I mean, that Ontario is one of the more, like, outrageous examples in Canada, maybe less so than BC now, which is so vicious. But over the years, since Harris particularly has come to power, you know, anyone who's not an idiot realizes that you can only get so much done through lobbying and through, like, constantly pleading for some kind of sense of compassion. It doesn't work. We've all done it. We've done it for years. We've done the delegations. We've had the reports written. We've appealed to their sensibilities. We've done the media savvy, heartwarming, you know, personalized stories and the street theater and the whole shebang. And the reality is it's not about popular support in and of itself. It's not about what looks embarrassing. It's not about, oh, if only we had realized how badly we were hurting people. It's about power. There's a reason they don't invest in affordable housing. It's not accidental. It's because it provides wealth for the people who support them. It provides wealth for the ruling class, and that's what the Tory Party represents. And so if we start to recognize that, then we have to look at the way that we strategize, the way that we take action, and the only thing that makes sense then is to recognize that, yeah, you can use that system when you need to and when it's smart to, but your bottom line is that you need to be taking action yourself to disrupt the functioning of that system. So whether it's people who work disrupting that system by going on strike or having work slowdowns or what have you, or whether it's like the economic disruption that we started to see with the provincial campaign against the Tories, or whether it's about taking back an abandoned building and putting yourself in a position where it really is, it's legally, it's in terms of popular support, in terms of what you're going to have to weather down the road, in terms of, like, what kind of a pain in the ass OCAP is capable of being. You know, you play all of these cards from outside the system in order to, essentially, to screw it up to whatever degree is necessary in order to win concessions, and that's sort of, like, the fundamental basis for this action.
Thanks to Clock Radio of Montreal for that story. For more information, visit the OCAP website at www.ocap.ca, OCAP.ca. Bringing privatization home to the Finger Lakes, the Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress is requesting supporters of the forest to contact their congresspeople regarding legislation that would permanently ban oil and gas companies from drilling in the national forest. Bills have been introduced into both houses of Congress. The Senate bill is 1846, that's 1846, and the House bill is H.R. 3460, that's 3460. These are bills to permanently ban drilling in the Finger Lakes National Forest.